This is What's Growing On, a show where we dig up the latest dirt on Ontario horticulture production, helping producers navigate best management practices and taste the sweet success of a quality crop. My name is Christy Greg McGuffin.
And I'm Cassie Russell. Join us while we talk with specialists in the field of fruit, vegetables, and specialty crops to find out what's really growing on. Welcome to episode 3 of What's Growing On. We have two special guests today. First off, we have Andrew C. Wiley, one of OMAFRA's new vegetable specialists, who's going to give us some more information on striped cucumber beetle in cucurbit crops.
And after that, we'll be chatting with Catherine Carter, fruit crop specialist for tender fruit and grape, about the factors impacting fruit set in grapes.
But first things first, let's cover some crop updates as of Friday, June 19th, 2020. Christy, how are fruit crops coming along this week?
Thanks, Cassie. Well, it's dry out there. Many fruit growing regions are 60 to 85% below the average rainfall over the last 30 days. And that's even less east of Toronto. Some areas are about 40 to 60% of the normal rainfall this time of year. So it's difficult because this is kind of the critical timing for many crops, as you know, the fruits forming and sizing. So growers are really, I mean, where they can, they're irrigating. And I mean, others are just hoping that some rain will come at least sometime soon. But in terms of fruit crop development, strawberry harvest, it's full swing right now. Pick your own operations have started, and those that have opened, they're managing well, kind of despite this COVID-19 restrictions that they're facing. But aphids are active in some fields, including the winged individuals. So this is going to be important because it's those individuals that can potentially spread viruses from field to field. Raspberry bloom continues as many fields start to progress towards the green fruit stage, and primocane fruiting raspberries are looking pretty good. In terms of the insects, raspberry sawfly and raspberry fruit worm have both been found. And in terms of blueberries, we've got green berries that are starting to be present now. So petal fall sprays for cranberry and cherry fruit worm are going on. And these might have some control as well on gypsy moth, which this year is really seeming to really be the year for gypsy moth. So it's nice to have that additional control. As well in blueberry fields, there have been some Phomopsis canker and twig blight that's been found. Now, for both berry and tenderfruit growers, the first spotted winged Drosophila has been caught in wild honeysuckle, and this was in the Essex County area in the earlier part of June. So far, no other catch has been reported yet in the other regions that are monitoring, but regular updates are being posted on the OnFruit blog, so be sure to check that out on a regular basis at onfruit.ca. In terms of apples, fruitlet thinning, it's wrapping up pretty well in most orchards. Bloom damage is really becoming more apparent from those May frosts that we had, and that's causing things like fruitlets to drop, some fruit to be misshapen, or signs of kind of frost rings or other russet marks. But the good thing is that there were quite a number of buds that we started the year out with. So overall, it seems as though a full crop is still expected at this point, but really only time will tell. So growers are taking advantage of these dry days right now to prune out the fire blight strikes that have started to develop around in many areas. And as well, primary scab period, it's passed in most areas, but the programs are still being maintained just for another few more weeks in order to ensure that there's no scab lesions that are actually present before they start relaxing on their rates and extending those interval lengths. From an insect standpoint in apples, codling moth sprays are starting to go on across the province. And San Jose scale, the first generation crawler emergence, is expected to begin in the earlier areas of the province this week, and it will continue for the next few weeks in terms of their activity. The other insect that's kind of on the radar now, dogwood borer adult flight, has started in many orchards, and these are orchards that have had a history with this pest, so they're actively monitoring for it. The thing with dogwood borer, this activity is going to continue until September, but peak flight typically happens about early July or so. From the tender fruit side of things, bacterial spot is starting to develop on peach, nectarine, plum, and apricots. Fruit are really susceptible to infection as soon as they're exposed at shuck split through pit hardening, but new infections can really develop until harvest. So severe fruit infections are more common when frequent periods of rainfall or even extended heavy dews or high humidity occur from that kind of late bloom stage to near pit hardening. Peaches are most susceptible to peach scab during the shuck split stage of growth, and because they lack the fuzz, nectarine fruit can be infected actually earlier than peaches, about 1 to 2 weeks after petal fall. So although fruit may become infected shortly after shuck split and continue to be susceptible to infection throughout the growing season, symptoms are typically not visible on the fruit for 6 to 10 weeks. So only those infections which were initiated between shuck split and 6 weeks before maturity will actually exhibit symptoms before harvest. So it's important with fungicides to choose those with activity on peach scab and use those in blocks with a history of peach scab until about 6 weeks pre-harvest. Now, in terms of other fungal pathogens, nectarine fruit are also now susceptible to powdery mildew infection, and that high humidity and overcast skies are really kind of optimal conditions for mildew proliferation. And for tart cherry orchards, cherry leaf spot and powdery mildew should be managed even if the crop has been lost to hail or to frost. These diseases can really defoliate trees and reduce the tree cold hardiness and productivity in subsequent years if it's left uncontrolled. From the grape side of things, sporulating downy mildew has been found on foliage and flower clusters in some vineyards. Infections this early in the growing season, that usually means it can be a challenging one to manage fruit infection as well. Black rot lesions have also been found in low severity, and powdery mildew is likely present in trace amounts, but it really hasn't been detected yet. And just a reminder that Rovrol is no longer an option for bunch rot control in grapevines as of June 20th, 2020. From the insect side of things with grapes, leafhoppers are really becoming more prevalent in vineyards, seeing potato, grape, three-banded, and Virginia creeper leafhoppers with this warmer, dry weather. So for more detailed information on specific crop updates, check out our On Fruit blog, where you'll find some regular postings for apple, berry, tenderfruit, and grapes. And that's at onfruit.ca. So that's it from my side, but what about you, Cassie? How are vegetables holding up in these dry conditions?
Thanks, Christy. So as of today, still really dry in most regions of Ontario. Not a lot of precipitation across the board, so some vegetables may be undergoing some additional stress from the heat. If you can, try and irrigate where possible. For updates in brassica crops, imported cabbage worm and diamondback moth larvae are active. For more detailed information on these and other lepidopteran pest thresholds in brassica crops, see the vegetable crop report from June 17, 2020. There are some really great photos and charts posted there. In garlic, leek moth larvae that are a little ahead of the second flight are starting to show damage. Scaping is a great opportunity to look at your plants in a bit more depth, so try and look at every plant for anything abnormal, including cuts, holes, white spots, and what appears to be sawdust, and kill any larvae that you might find. As celery plants establish, make sure you're scouting for early symptoms of celery leaf curl. If aster leafhopper counts were active in the past weeks on celery crops, keep a close eye on plants showing symptoms of aster yellows. Tarnished plant bugs are active, and thresholds have been reached in all regions. In leafy greens, leaf miners continue to cause damage and cutworm pressure is high in some areas. Seed corn maggot is reaching its second threshold for Essex County and may be causing some poor emergence in later plantings. In onions, direct seeded onions are reaching the fourth leaf stage in many areas and transplants are starting to take off. Scout for early thrips, especially around fields that border hay that's been recently cut. scout for wilting and dig up suspect plants to determine if wireworms, millipedes, or onion maggots are the cause. Also, now is a great time to be scouting for stunting caused by onion smut. On to carrots. Irrigation continues for most carrots as the dry conditions are difficult on the establishing crop. Growers are having a hard time getting good activation of the pre-emergent herbicides, and pigweed is thriving in this weather. Carrot weevil is still of concern this week as adults are outlaying eggs currently, but we will be nearing the end of the egg laying period soon. For potatoes, there are leafhoppers around, as mentioned, especially where areas that hay has been cut, so make sure you're scouting your fields for any signs of adults or nymphs. Thresholds, as a reminder, are 20 nymphs per 50 leaves or 15 adults per 50 leaves. Now is also a great time to be looking for Colorado potato beetle eggs and hatching larvae to make sure your at-plant insecticide is holding up. In beets, Cercospora leaf spot has been observed in field plots in Ridgetown campus. The presence of symptoms in the region, coupled with the closing of the canopy, indicates that preventative fungicide programs should be initiated soon if they haven't been already. In asparagus, harvest is mostly wrapped up and ferns should be scouted for fungal diseases and insect pests. Sweet corn has been growing well throughout Ontario. There has been some armyworm activity, so focus scouting in the evenings when the caterpillars are most active. And lastly, for cucurbits, cucumber beetle continues to be found in large numbers, and some transplants have been exposed to the bacterial wilt pathogen early in the season due to the high number of cucumber beetles. And we will dive a little deeper into this topic of cucumber beetle and bacterial wilt in just a second on our vegetable segment.
For more detailed information on these and other fruit and vegetable crops, check out our weekly crop updates at onvegetables.com and onfruit.ca.
Today, I'm welcoming OMAFR's Acting Vegetable Crop Specialist, Andrew C. Wiley, who's joining us to talk about a common pest of cucurbit crops, the striped cucumber beetle. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, Cassie.
We've been hearing a lot this season about damage to cucurbit crops from striped cucumber beetle. I'm wondering if the damage is especially high this season, maybe because populations are higher or because of the temperatures we've been seeing. What's your general take on this?
Yeah, the striped cucumber beetle has really emerged in force this season, and I'm seeing a lot of damage so far. If you've grown cucurbits, then you're probably familiar with these beetles. They're really very common, but this year they do seem to have come out in larger numbers than usual. They're not usually a huge problem for commercial growers because there are thiamethoxam seed treatments for them and in-furrow treatments using imidacloprid that both work to control adult populations for the first 4 to 6 weeks after planting, which effectively covers the first emergence in spring. But I've spoken with growers who've seen large populations on commercial cucurbits this season, so I think it's a good time to focus some energy on scouting for these pests.
Okay, and can you tell me a little bit more about these beetles, especially for someone who maybe hasn't seen them before, so what they exactly look like?
Yeah, it's actually a really cool looking little beetle. It's about 6 or 7 millimeters long, or about 1/4 of an inch. It's got yellow forewings, 2 black stripes on each forewing, although when they're resting, the 2 inner stripes are touching. So to the naked eye, it looks like there are 3 stripes on the beetle's back. There are some lookalikes, but these beetles are pretty distinctive once you get to know them. I've actually posted some photos on our weekly vegetable crop report from last Thursday, June 18th, which you can find at onvegetables.com. One really distinctive feature of these beetles is its black lower legs. It looks like it's wearing black knee socks. The adults of the western corn rootworm have a similar appearance to the striped cucumber beetle, but the stripes on its wing pads don't go all the way to the tips of its wings, and its legs are black, so it doesn't look like it's wearing socks.
Those are some awesome descriptions. And this is a pest that occurs year after year in Ontario, right?
Yeah, that's right. We do see them most years. Cucumber beetles like to overwinter in wooded areas or in plant debris, and they're not terrible flyers, so they can pretty easily move into your crop from adjacent forested areas. They'll come out once temperatures start to rise to about 10 degrees Celsius in the spring, so we'll see them in April or May.
Now, that's kind of interesting because that's quite a bit earlier than when we plant cucurbits in Ontario. Do they not need a cucurbit host to feed on in the early spring?
Well, they do really prefer cucurbits, but when they emerge, they'll happily enough eat pollen and flower petals and stuff from other species while they're waiting for you to get your transplants out into the field.
And so I guess since the beetles are present quite early in the spring, you should start scouting as soon as those transplants are in the ground.
Yeah, that's right. You want to start quite early. Definitely by the time you're transplanting, you should be starting to scout. And some good tips for scouts are that you should look in the early morning, and you should focus on areas around your fields that are near potential overwintering sites, such as sheltered areas or forests. And this, you'll be able to get an idea of the population levels of the emerged adult beetles. Once those adults have found your cucurbits, then they'll lay eggs at the base of the plants. And then when those eggs hatch, the larvae will feed on the roots for a couple weeks before the second generation of beetles emerges later in the season.
And is it the adult stage that damages the crop solely, or does feeding from the larva also cause problems for growers?
Actually, yeah, the adult feeding is much more damaging to the crop. The larvae don't seem to have as much of an effect on the overall health of the plant.
That's interesting because it's kind of opposite to a lot of the other insect pests we see, especially in vegetables. Now, in addition to scouting for adults, should individuals also be scouting for the damage that striped cucumber beetle leave on the plants, or using maybe other monitoring tools?
Yeah, that's a good point. Scouting for damage is helpful too. The damage from cucumber beetles is direct feeding. They chew on the foliage and they can skeletonize leaves pretty quickly. They'll also feed directly on the fruit, which can affect its marketability. They'll also feed on flowers, and that can really reduce your yields, obviously. Some growers use yellow sticky cards to catch them and count them. You'll want to be scouting 2 or 3 times per week because the populations can fluctuate quite rapidly. As I said, you should be scouting very early in the morning because once the day starts to heat up, the beetles will go and hide in the soil. If you're scouting plants, the threshold is 0.5 to 1 cucumber beetle per plant on seedlings and up to 5 beetles per plant on a mature plant.
And did you want to maybe tell us about some of the management strategies available to control for cucumber beetle if these thresholds are met?
Yeah, those are pretty low thresholds. I mentioned the seed treatments and the neonicotinoid in-furrow treatment early in the season. And then later in the season, the most common treatment is going to be to spray pyrethroid insecticides such as Matador. There are plenty of integrated pest management strategies that can be used to try to keep the populations low. For example, you can use row covers to protect the young plants from the early emergences of beetles in the spring, as long as you can get them on before the cucumber beetles start to emerge, which can be a bit of a challenge if it's windy.
Right. And it's important to remove those row covers before pollination, correct?
Yeah, that's right. This strategy is just to target the emergence and protect the young plants, but you don't want to have those on for too long and risk blocking out your important pollinators. Another IPM tool you can use is kaolin clay. This is permitted for organic production in Canada. It's a really fine clay. It's used in cosmetics, and it coats the plants and discourages the beetles from feeding. Some things to keep in mind when you're using this compound is that it's not rain fast, so you have to keep applying it. And it also leaves a residue, which can affect the marketability of cucurbit fruits. It also needs to be applied pretty carefully to get complete coverage, but it does seem to work quite well.
Okay, now something I did want to ask you about is I understand that some varieties of cucurbits are more attractive to cucumber beetles. So can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, cucumber beetles, they're attracted to chemicals called chiromones, such as cucurbitacin, which are released by the plants. Different cucurbit cultivars release varying levels of these chemicals. So there's a general difference in attractiveness between the large groups of cucurbits. Zucchini is the most attractive to the beetles, followed by pumpkins, then squash, and finally, cucumber is the least attractive. There are some really attractive varieties out there. For example, we use the Burgess butternut squash in our trials to try to attract large numbers of beetles. Other great candidates are Turk's turban squash, blackjack zucchini, embassy zucchini, and lots of others. So the strategy that you want to employ with these is to use them either as a trap or an indicator plant in your field. If you plant the attractive varieties in between the overwintering sites and your main crop, the beetles are going to go to the trap crop first, and then you can deal with the beetle populations on these plants before they get to your crop. And one thing to mention here is that if you're removing the beetles or if you're spraying for them on the trap crop, if any of your trap plants appear to have bacterial wilt, you should remove these plants immediately so that it doesn't spread to your crop.
Right. And that's probably because the cucumber beetles vector the bacteria wilts between your different cucurbit hosts.
Yeah, exactly. Striped cucumber beetles are the main vector of the Erwinia pathogen that causes bacterial wilt in cucurbits. It can be quite a damaging disease, and it's transmitted to the cucurbit plants mechanically by the mouth parts of the beetle as it's feeding. The bacteria can actually be transmitted by other beetles, such as the spotted cucumber beetle, the western spotted cucumber beetle, the banded cucumber beetle. But in Ontario this season, the striped cucumber beetle is the one that we've been seeing lots of, and it's historically much more common than the spotted cucumber beetle in Ontario.
Okay. And how could I tell if I had melons or cucumbers that had bacterial wilt, and that they just aren't wilting from something like water stress or some other infection?
Well, you could always send some tissue to a plant diagnostic lab for an analysis, but there's actually an easy test for infection by the bacterium that causes this wilt, and it's due to the presence of large numbers of this bacterium in the xylem of infected plants. The plants wilt because the xylem's choked by a film produced by this species, and if you find a runner on the plant that's wilting and you cut it close to the crown, just hold the two pieces back together for a second and then slowly pull them apart. If they're infected, there'll be huge amounts of the bacterium in the xylem, and you'll be able to see this sticky slime between the two pieces when you pull them apart from each other. This sticky film can tell you that your plants are definitely infected with the bacterium, and it's these masses of bacteria jamming up the plant's vasculature and then the production of resins and gums in response to this infection that actually causes the wilt itself.
Wow, that's actually really cool. But I'm assuming once you see those signs in the plant tissue, it's just game over for the entire plant.
Unfortunately, yes. Once your plants are infected, there's not much that you can do. Controlling bacterial wilt really relies on controlling the cucumber beetle vector. The bacteria can't survive the death of the host plant tissue, so once the plants die, the bacterium is going to die as well. It's not viable in dead plant tissue for very long. It relies on the cucumber beetle for overwintering, and although it can't reproduce in the beetles, it's presence on their mouth parts when they're feeding on your plants is going to lead to this disease. And this is why thresholds are so low for this pest.
And on the topic of bacterial wilt, do the cultivars that attract more beetles also have higher instances of bacterial wilt? Because if that's the case, then maybe planting a trap crop is a little bit more risky to a grower.
Actually, that's really interesting, because the order of preference to beetles is exactly opposite to the susceptibility to wilt. So zucchini are the most attractive cucurbit to these beetles, but they're the least susceptible to bacterial wilt. There are pumpkin varieties that are susceptible, but many are not. And then melons are quite susceptible to wilt, but the beetles are less attracted to them. That said, I just spoke with a melon grower who had left some trays of transplants out in their headlands, only to return to find that the trays were completely infested with cucumber beetles. Interestingly, watermelon is not very susceptible to bacterial wilt compared to other cucurbits. And cucumbers are the most susceptible cucurbit to bacterial wilt. And although they're the least attractive to cucumber beetles, as the name implies, they'll still be attacked by these beetles. And so they need to be scouted as well.
Now it's funny because maybe we need to rename the cucumber beetle to something like zucchini beetle that more reflects its preferences.
Yeah, I agree. We could call them zucchini beetles. Who do you think we talked to about that?
I guess I'll have to call up some of my taxonomist friends. So I wanted to ask, is there any new work being done on cucumber beetle control in cucurbits? Maybe any work that you're involved in?
Yeah, there's work going on at many levels in managing cucumber beetles. The standard controls for this beetle, Admire and Matador, can be harmful to beneficial insects. Admire is a neonicotinoid and Matador is a pyrethroid. We're working with the Truman Lab at the University of Guelph to test the efficacy of alternatives to neonics and pyrethroids on the cucumber beetle. And we're looking at some of the diamide compounds. We're going to be doing trials in the late summer on this out at Ridgetown.
That's awesome. Wish you guys success with those trials for sure. It's really always great to hear when researchers are looking into more control options to add some more tools to a grower's toolbox. And that being said, what are some places that growers or consultants can go to find out more information on cucumber beetle monitoring or control options?
Yeah, there's lots of places to go find more information about cucumber beetle. Our Ontario Crop IPM website has a section on cucumber beetles that has more information and pictures. And Michigan State has a great article about cucumber beetles on their extension page, which is a great starting point. Elaine Roddy from OMAFRA wrote a very informative article on the cucumber beetle for The Grower in December of 2019, which you can find in the archives at thegrower.org. And I'd say most gardens that have cucurbit transplants in them are probably infested right now. So there's lots of opportunity to go get some hands-on experience with identifying these little beetles.
Right. Good to know.
Also, the new edition of our crop protection publication 838 is available online to download now on the OMAFRA website. And it lists some of the products that growers have available to them. Keep in mind that it's always important to check with the PMRA pesticide label search at the Health Canada website as well to see about any product updates or reevaluations.
That's great. Well, thank you, Andrew, again for sharing all this information and coming on the podcast today. It's great to have some more information on the striped cucumber beetle and the threat it poses to different cucurbit crops that we grow here in Ontario.
Yeah, thanks again, Cassie. And for any Ontario growers out there listening, let me know if you're finding any cucumber beetle infestations on commercial acreages. We're particularly interested here at OMAFRA if you're seeing feeding on plants that have been treated with any of the imidacloprids such as Admire, Alias, or Grapple. And just a final note that I also cover a variety of other crops such as asparagus, beans and peas, sweet corn, and rhubarb. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out.
That's great. Thanks again, Andrew. It was a pleasure getting to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Always happy to talk about cucumber beetles.
And that was Andrew C. Wiley, Acting Vegetable Crop Specialist for the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food, and Rural Affairs.
On today's fruit segment, I'm joined by Catherine Carter, who is the OMAFRA Fruit Crop Specialist for Tender Fruit and Grape. Thanks for being here, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
So, okay, I'm going to be honest with you for a second. So, working in tree fruit, I find, especially this time of year, I tend to get pretty tunnel visioned, right? So I focus on my crop at that particular time. And so I'm kind of realizing as I'm doing this podcast that I get this chance to kind of step back and really see what's going on in the world of horticulture. And it's, you know, it's really diverse in the province. And we've got so many, I think, between the industries, there's so many differences in terms of production practices, but also similarities.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, talking today with us, you know, it's a kind of a good opportunity to highlight, you know, these sort of things. So anyway, so long way of me saying, I'm really excited to talk to you.
And I think, thank you. I'm excited to talk to you.
So I think, I wanted to talk to you today in terms of grapefruit set and, you know, what sort of factors influence it and kind of get an idea of what sort of activities are, you know, happening in vineyards during bloom. And so now, am I correct with my understanding we're getting close to bloom in some grape cultivars?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. So flowering or bloom usually occurs about 4 to 6 weeks after bud break, which is usually around June 20th. But obviously, it varies depending upon the environmental conditions of different elements.
So I've heard before that grape blossoms can be a little bit more vulnerable than other blooms. Can you explain why that is?
So grape blossoms aren't protected from flower petals. And so once they're open, strong winds can shake the pollen from the vines. Oh. And that can prevent some of the flowers from pollinating. So strong winds, hail, frost, those can also cause similar risks. And that can affect the pollination process, which can impact fruit set.
Wow. So I've never thought about the protection that petals can provide a flower. Well, so now in tree fruit, we bring in honeybees for pollination. Do bees play a role in pollination for grapes?
So honeybees will often visit the vineyard, but they're not needed for the grape pollination process since grapevines are hermaphroditic. And so they have both the female ovaries as well as the male stamens. And by the nature of the plants, usually about 50% of the flowers in a given grape cluster will not set just because of just the biology of the grapes. Which is actually a good thing for growers.
Wait, why is it a good thing for not all the flowers to set fruit?
So excessively high fruit set can actually delay the ripening of the clusters, and it can also result in very tight or compact clusters that tend to be prone to disease. So fruit set in a way can be considered a self-thinning technique that allows the vine to try to regulate the crop. So individual flower death isn't always a bad outcome, since it can result in better ripening of the fruit, and it can reduce the incidence of disease as well, too. bigger issue with really reduced fruit set is really when you have a loss of fruit clusters, and that can have an impact on reduced yields.
So then is there an optimal crop yield that growers should be trying to aim for?
That's a great question. Although there are some people that believe that there's a target number of 4 to 6 tons per acre for grapevines to get high quality wine, research shows that in reality, things are a little bit more complicated. And crop yields for optimal quality really vary from site to site depending on the cultivar and the soil type. So high yields of grapes on heavier soils can cause off-flavoring. However, if fruit production of grapevines on very vigorous or sandy soils is too low, then the vines will become excessively vigorous and it can cause issues with shading as well as reducing the fruit quality and the wine quality as well too. So really, when it comes to grape production, it's all about finding balance, that balance between vigor as well as fruit production to try to produce a high quality wine. And so obviously the numbers of flowers that set fruit will have a significant impact on the yields.
Yeah, so it's quite the balancing act, kind of that too much, too little, depending on the site. But so you said the number of flowers that set fruit. So is there an exact number of how many flowers you need to have a good crop?
So in general, each grape flower cluster has hundreds of flowers. However, you only want about 50% of the flowers within each cluster to set fruit and become berries. Poor fruit set occurs when less than 30% of the flowers will set, and it can result in clusters with few berries, or it can result in clusters with very small green or short berries that fail to ripen and drop off before harvest. So as you can imagine, losing the entire flower cluster can have a negative impact on the yields, and fruit set requirements will really vary between cultivars.
So, well, and how does one go about evaluating this fruit set?
Good question. So fruit set usually occurs about 10 to 14 days after full bloom, and the pollinated flowers start to become small berries that will eventually form into those grapes. And at this time, vineyard managers can start estimating the percentage of each grape cluster that will grow into fruit. While weather events such as hail, drought, or rainfall can still affect the season, fruit set is the first indicator how abundant or the lack of abundant a harvest may be. So it's important to record the percentage of the fruit set, which is a measure of the proportion of flowers that have developed into berries following bloom.
Okay, well, and you mentioned that weather can affect crop yields for the rest of the season, but does weather at bloom also impact fruit setting grapes?
Yes, absolutely. Cool, cloudy, or wet conditions can have a negative impact on flower development, resulting in fewer berries. Temperatures below 18 degrees Celsius or above 38 degrees Celsius during bloom can slow the growth of the pollen tube that results in reduced fruit set. So cool weather during bloom is believed to be associated with variability in berry size within a cluster. So we often call this hens and chicks, where you have small berries and larger grape berries in the same cluster. Rain during bloom prevents the calyptra or caps for the flower petals from detaching from the flower, and it can also result in a reduction in pollination. Water stress during bloom can also have a negative impact on fruit set, and some cultivars such as Merlot and Gewurz are more susceptible to weather, while other cultivars such as Pinot and Chardonnay may be more tolerant.
So weather at bloom and during the season can impact fruit set, but what about things like spring frosts or winter injury? Can they impact the number of grape clusters?
Yes, so frost and winter injury can damage the fruit buds. So grapes have a primary, secondary, and tertiary buds that form the previous year. If frost or winter injury damages the primary fruit bud and the secondary fruit bud survives, then it will result in a significant reduction in fruit clusters and reduced yields, but you will still get a crop. If the primary and secondary buds are both killed off and only the tertiary bud survives, then the plant will survive, but there won't be any clusters to set fruit. Fortunately, this year we were slightly behind normal in grape crop development when the frosts hit in early May, and so bud burst hadn't occurred in many of the grape varieties, and we had minimal damage in grape buds. So we didn't see a lot of impact from frost this year, and the winter was a relatively mild winter, and so we didn't see a lot of winter damage as well, too, in most of the grape varieties.
Okay, so you said most. I caught that there. does that mean that some did have winter injury?
Yes, there are some reports of some winter injury in vineyards on late harvesting cultivars. These are cultivars that were still, they still had grapes on the vine at harvest when we had those cold frosts around November the 11th. And those vines may not have had the chance to harden off before those frosts occurred. And we believe that that may have resulted in some winter injury at that point in time.
Well, okay, let's kind of switch gears a little bit here. So we talked about, you know, how weather can impact fruit set, both kind of that in season as well as this potential for winter injury. But what about vine health? Like, how much does nutrition have an impact on fruit set?
Yeah, vine nutrition from last season has a large impact on the number of flower clusters in the bud and on a shoot. Prior to bloom, grapevines use their nutrient reserves from last year to try to provide support from the vine. So vines with nutrient deficiency may be more prone to poor fruit set. So research suggests that boron and zinc are probably the most important nutrients for fruit set in grapes. Boron can have an impact on pollen tube generation, and it's needed for fertilization. Some work conducted by Dr. Tim Martinson from Cornell University showed that both soil and foliar applications of boron before bloom can improve fruit set on Concord grapes in a vineyard where boron was deficient. This was vineyards where they actually had a documented boron deficiency. Adding boron to vineyards where there isn't a deficiency can actually cause issues with phytotoxicity. So it's important to be aware as to what the nutrient levels are before applying boron. Zinc deficiency isn't a common issue in Ontario vineyards. However, if a block consistently shows zinc deficiency and inadequate fruit set, it might be worthwhile to apply a foliar application of zinc to try to help fruit set. The ratio of carbon to nitrogen may also have an impact. Vines with an unbalanced carbon-nitrogen status are vines that tend to be very excessively vigorous or weak vines. These vines may be more prone to poor flower development and fruit set, and some studies have shown that nitrogen levels may be the reason for early season necrosis of the fruit clusters.
So if vine health and nutrition are so important for fruit set, then how should growers be monitoring for nutrient levels?
So nutrient levels in grapes can be assessed either at bloom or at veraison, which is the ripening process. Although soil samples provide some useful information to determine what's happening in the vineyard, petiole samples really provide the best information on what nutrients the vine is accessing and what nutrient deficiencies are a concern. So petiole samples should be collected every other year to try to monitor nutrient levels. And if petiole samples indicate that boron levels are low, 1 to 2 sprays of boron before bloom may be applied to those vines. Some research in California has suggested that the application of boron in vineyards is more effective if it's applied in the fall. However, this probably doesn't really work for our climatic conditions just because we get our temperatures after harvest drop so quickly that it probably doesn't really have enough time to uptake the boron. So our better timing for our climatic conditions is really applying that boron in the spring.
Okay. And when you mentioned sampling every other year, but how exactly do you collect samples to monitor for vine health?
Sure. So at bloom, you collect a total of 100 petioles from leaves that are opposite the first or second flower cluster from the bottom of the shoot. So you don't want to collect more than 1 or 2 petioles per vine. And those petioles can be collected, put in a brown paper bag, and stored at room temperature for 24 hours to kind of dry them out, and then submitted to a lab for analysis. Veraison petiole samples can be collected from mature, fully expanded leaves, 5 to 7 leaves from the shoot tip. And regardless of the timing of when samples are collected, it's really important to sample throughout the vineyard and to try to collect samples from similar soil types, age of vines, similar varieties, rootstocks, and cultural practices.
Well, okay, and with going back to tree fruit, we often have kind of, again, this, you know, this balancing act between getting the right nutrient levels for good growth, but then not having an overly vigorous tree that might impact fruit set. So does the vigor of the vine impact fruit set in grapes as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So shoot tips, or the tips of the vine, will compete with the blossoms for nutrients and resources. And so an excessively vigorous vine will put more resources into the shoot tips than into the flower clusters, and that can have a negative impact on flower development and result in poor fruit set. Weak vines have fewer sources of stored carbon and nitrogen, resulting in shoots pulling more nutrients from those flowers and leading to poor fruit set as well, too.
Okay. Well, and so it's clear then that weather and nutrition and vine vigor, they all impact fruit set. Are there other things that can also impact this?
Generally, the healthier the vine, the better it is for the fruit set. So any vines that have insect damage or disease pressure, those ones tend to be more prone to poor fruit set, issues with viruses such as red blotch. So if you're seeing poor fruit set in the vineyard, it's really important to take a closer look to determine the cause of what causes the fruit set. Water stress from previous years can have a significant impact on fruit bud development and fruit set the following year as well, too. And interestingly enough, there's been a little bit of research from Michigan suggesting that the application of certain fungicides at bloom can actually have a negative impact on fruit set in Concord grapes. And so while this is just preliminary information, it stresses the importance of being aware of what we're doing and the impact of everything that we're doing in the vineyard on potential fruit set.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and so now that we know kind of the components that affect fruit set, are there anything that growers can use to help increase fruit set, like especially in those varieties where set may be poor?
Yeah, absolutely. So canopy management can be a great tool in helping to increase fruit set. So shoot tipping or removing those vigorous tips, shoot tips at bloom, can help to consistently increase fruit set. And so by taking off those shoot tips that act as a competition for the nutrients with the fruit clusters, it allows actually for more nutrients to be available to the fruit clusters. So there are some challenges with doing this practice, though. It can cost a fair amount of money to do because it has to be done, usually has to be done by hand, because the shoots aren't long enough at bloom to be cut with a mechanical hedger. And removing the shoot tip from the main shoot can encourage lateral growth, which can cause some issues with shading and disease problems if you get a big push of lateral shoots happening as well, too.
Hmm. Okay, well, what about the other extreme? How about options for reducing fruit set?
Yeah, absolutely. So early leaf removal before bloom or during bloom can also help to reduce fruit set and reduce the compactness of those fruit clusters. So by removing leaves from around the fruit cluster zone just prior to or at the beginning of bloom, it can help by removing the source of photosynthesis to flowers. So resulting in more flowers not fertilizing and reducing the amount of berries that can be sustained. So it can be an effective solution to trying to reduce the compactness of those tight clustered varieties. And usually removal of the basal, about 4 to 5 different basal leaves, no later than trace bloom, has been shown to have some impact on reducing fruit set and reducing the cluster compactness, which can result in some benefits in terms of reducing the susceptibility to rots later on in the season. Once again, this is a labor-intensive task, and it all has to be done manually, and so it can be very expensive to do as well. However, there's also another option is plant growth regulators, such as gibberellic acid, can be used in other grapes, like table grapes, to try to decrease fruit set, and those ones will help to produce a longer rachis and larger berries.
So what tools do growers have to help reduce yields?
So with respect to managing yields, there are several options available to growers. Dormant pruning can help reduce the number of clusters on the vine and open the canopy to try to improve sunlight penetration. Around bloom, growers can also use shoot thinning to try to reduce excess shoots in inflorescence. And shoot thinning can also decrease the shoot density to create a well-balanced canopy with uniform shoots, and it helps to eliminate any of the weak and unfruitful shoots as well, too. Later in the season, high crop loads can create issues with ripening, especially in cool seasons or in summers when the vines have been stressed due to drought. So fruit clusters can also be removed later in the season to try to help the vine balance and to find a balance between vine growth and production as well, too. Keep in mind that all of these tools still rely on clusters being present on the fruit. So without good fruit set, regardless of the numbers of clusters on the vine, there won't be a good crop.
Yeah, so it really sounds like it just basically all comes down to getting that fruit set in the first place, really, right? What you can control, at least, besides those weather events.
Yes, absolutely.
So you've brought up a number of factors that are involved in fruit set in grapes, but kind of what would you say would be like the take-home message for this?
I think there are many different factors that impact fruit set in wine grapes, including weather, vine nutrition and health, vine vigor balance, as well as different cultivars and rootstocks. So if you have issues with your fruit set in your vineyard, then it's really important to document those observations, because that may provide some useful information to determine the cause of the problem. And it's best to evaluate fruit set about 10 to 12 days after bloom to determine exactly what you anticipate with respect to a crop as well, too. So I think those are good take-home messages to be aware of the importance of fruit set and the potential implications of various different things on fruit set.
That's great. Well, so thanks so much then for talking with me today. I think this is, you know, definitely on the minds of many grape growers right now that we're approaching bloom. So I really do hope that it's a productive year then for fruit set.
I hope so too.
So thanks, Catherine.
Thanks a lot, Christy. I appreciate it.
I was just speaking with Catherine Carter, fruit crop specialist for tenderfruit and grapes with the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs. Well, that brings our episode to a close. This has been Christy Greg McGuffin.
And Cassie Russell for the What's Growing On podcast. For more information on horticulture grown in Ontario, check out the links to our fruit, vegetable, and specialty crop blogs in the show notes.
And big thanks again to our guests this week, Andrew C. Wiley and Catherine Carter. And another big shout out goes again this week to Michael Pupulin for editing our episodes. Music for this episode is once again the track Aspire from Scott Holmes.
We will be back in 2 weeks with an all-new episode of What's Growing On. In the meantime, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for a topic you'd like us to cover, please send us an email at onhortcrops@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.